The Tom Woods Show, episode 1012.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, like many of us, there's a good chance you were probably a victim of educational malpractice. Well, undo all that over at libertyclassroom.com, where we teach you the history and economics you didn't get in school. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. This is going to be a good one. We're talking about Marx and Marxism with Professor Jared Casey, who is back again and whose brand new book, Freedom's Progress, with a question mark, A History of Political Thought, is just an amazing treasure of insight and wit and learning. It's just amazing. It's a tremendous book. Who knows how many episodes we can generate out of it. But in particular, I thought, what the heck? Marxism is something that's juicy and people like to hear about and learn about. So I thought that is our next topic. There's nothing that says we have to go through this book in chronological order. So I skipped ahead a bit. I skipped ahead, a few millennia, more or less, a couple of millennia. Anyway, Professor Casey is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at University College Dublin, where he used to be head of the department. And he's written a number of other books, including a book on Murray Rothbard called Murray Rothbard, and a book called Libertarian Anarchy Against the State that is also a tremendous one, but nothing is going to match his magnum opus, which is Freedom's Progress. Absolutely amazing. Professor Casey, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Welcome back a bit sooner than you may have thought, actually. Here you are already. It's been barely a week, and here you are again. Well, I couldn't resist. I've got this book on every interesting topic under the sun, and a guy who's so genial, he's willing to talk to me as often as I like. So, well, I am going to take advantage of that situation. So we thought we'd talk about Karl Marx today. I've done some episodes on Marx. I'm not altogether thrilled with any of them, just because there's so much to get a handle on with Marx. You can do one little topic or another little topic. I'd really like to try to do the whole thing, at least not answer every scholarly debate about it, but at least try and feel like we've hit on the whole picture that Marx is painting. So what I think we'll do, given that you and I discussed this before we went on and couldn't really come to a decision about what particular points we should cover, we're just going to talk about Marx until we collapse from exhaustion. Or I have a certain number of minutes in mind, so you don't have to worry this is going to go on for 8 hours. But on the other hand, maybe it would sell some books. All right, so let's talk about Marx. Before we get into his thought, is there anything in Marx's personal life that you find especially revealing, given the type of ideology he would later develop?
Well, yes. I mean, you have to be careful here, because in the end, it's not the kind of life a person lives that's really important from the point of view of their ideas, but the ideas themselves. And you have to be careful that you don't engage in an ad hominem. However, that being said, it is the case that with certain writers, what they think is to some extent an expression of their personality at the deepest level. I would think, for example, of St. Augustine as one of those people, and Rousseau would be another, and indeed Marx is also one. So I think in the case of some authors, I think it is actually helpful to know something about the kind of life that they led and so on. I think that adds to the understanding of their thinking. And Marx is a really interesting character. I mean, his background was Jewish, although his family had converted. But nonetheless, he had a strain of anti-Semitism, which was remarkable even for the more or less endemic anti-Semitism that was current in the 19th century. He, like Rousseau, as Rousseau sort of loved mankind in general, but no one in particular, that he managed to hate a lot of people. So Marx as well sort of loved workers in the round and at a distance, but for the individual workers, he had nothing but scorn. He was really, I suppose, to some extent, an academic manque. He had sort of failed as an academic, and he sort of despised manual workers, you know, so he had a very sort of strange attitude towards work for somebody whose major work is capital and the critique of capitalism. He also was a very strange scholar, if indeed what he was. Once he came to England, by the way, and he never learned to speak English properly, which is really bizarre. I mean, he spent what, 35 years living in England as Engels' pensioner, and never managed to speak English properly, never managed to visit an English factory, despite the fact that Engels, who was pensioning him off, actually owned a factory in Manchester, and locked himself up effectively in the British Museum. Also, even though he has some claim, I suppose, to be an economist of repute, and in terms of his influence, certainly is vitally important, even if his thought isn't in the end all that coherent. Nonetheless, he didn't really keep up with developments, and he didn't really keep up with the Mengerian principle as it was developed in the 1860s and 1870s.
Marginal utility and subjective value, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So a very strange character indeed.
Right. Okay, yeah, so now let's go from there. I mean, there are stories about the way he treated people, and you're right, he doesn't seem to have had any interest in actual real-life workers and all that. Let's get into the meat of his thought here. And to do that, let's actually go right to the Communist Manifesto. It's short, it's understandable, and let's see what we glean from it in terms of what is he calling for. I mean, we will talk about his economics because you have to, but what kind of a society is he calling for? Now, first thing is, I do want you to say something about what he has to say about the bourgeoisie, which is the class that will ultimately have to be smashed and expropriated. But he and Engels have some kind words for the bourgeoisie because they appreciate its role in history.
Indeed. In fact, if you were to read those first few pages of the Communist Manifesto out without giving the source and ask people to identify who the author was, my guess is that most people would have a lot of trouble identifying who the authors were, and indeed probably would get it seriously wrong. Probably Adam Smith might come into contention. But so Marx and Engels in their Communist Manifesto, which was written when Marx was a very young man in just about 30, the bourgeoisie were praised for providing cheap and plentiful commodities, creating a huge number of towns, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing continents for cultivation, and indeed the canalization of rivers, the application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, and in a wonderful phrase, rescuing a considerable part of the population from the idiocy of rural life. Okay, so that's not a bad pee in a phrase.
No, it's not. But what I find interesting, gosh, I'm afraid we're gonna look. I'm just gonna cover stuff. We're just gonna go till we're exhausted. Okay,
all right.
Because I want to talk about on the minus side what he says about capitalism, because the minus side is actually quite bizarre when you read through what his criticisms are of the role of the bourgeoisie in history. And by the way, what do we mean by bourgeoisie? In case anybody's confused.
Well, the bourgeoisie was the class of people who emerged, I suppose, contemporaneously with the Industrial Revolution. Those who were those people and those who served them in the middle, the industrialists, the factory owners, those who took advantage of the technology developed in the late 18th and in the 19th century to increase production enormously. Which indeed, as we all know, increased for the first time in a really significant way, was the major event which increased the ability of human beings to earn something well above the bare standard of living, of survival that they had done since almost the beginning of human history.
All right. So in other words, it doesn't really translate that well. People sometimes translate it as middle class, but in a 21st century sense, middle class is like, it's still a wage laborer or a salaried employee or something. And that's not what he has in mind with bourgeoisie. These are the people who own the means of production. These are the people who will have to be. And then there's some controversy about whether he really intends that there must be a violent confrontation with them. That's a separate matter. So anyway, let's go back to what are the minuses of the bourgeoisie in history?
Now here, this is where it gets really, really strange. So we've just had a list of all the wonderful things that the bourgeoisie have produced or supported. And you might say, okay, well, what's on the negative side? And it turns out that they're criticized, wait for it. I mean, this is really hard to believe, but if you don't believe me, go and read the Communist Manifesto yourself. The bourgeoisie are criticized for having ended feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations and torn aside the ties that bound a man to his natural superior. Okay, and turning the intellectuals and the professionals into wage laborers. Now, this is really, really strange. There is, in a way, to anybody who knows a little bit about history here, you can see there's a sort of deep vein of romanticism running all the way. This may sound very strange to say about Marxism, but there's a deep vein of romanticism running all the way through Marx's thought. And you're beginning to wonder, what idyllic conditions was he talking about? Where have these ever been manifest in history? Okay, they might have been manifest for a very small number of people at a particular time, those who managed to corner most of the wealth. But for most people, for most of human history, had been struggling, if you like, to make a living. And indeed, anything like a bad harvest or, you know, bad weather conditions could lead to ruin, starvation, and death. So where is this? Where were these idylls? And who was living in them? I have no idea. I don't know that Marx has either.
No, nor do I. And then the bourgeoisie has torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, so that nothing remains to connect one person to another, even in the family, save the cash nexus. So we've often heard this claim that, well, capitalism binds you only by cash and explicit contract and whatever. And so this is Marx's romanticism coming through, that, ah, for the days when we were bound by something greater than mere cash. Well, I'd rather be bound by cash than feudal relations, you creep. And even though, of course, he's supposed to be against feudalism because capitalism is the next stage in historical development, but capitalism supposedly tears asunder all these other ways human beings might be bound together other than cash. But anything that preceded capitalism was vastly worse in that regard. I mean, what's the most charitable reading of this?
I don't really know. I mean, I've obviously read the material and I've written on it, and I'm kind of mystified by it. As I say, you really have to think that somebody is in the grip of a theory here, looking back, as it were, at some kind of golden age in the past. But in a way, that runs against other things than Marx, because Marx is really future directed, because the golden age for Marx is really more in the future than in the past. Now, it's not impossible, by the way, that you could have a golden age in the past and in the future. But I find this these particular criticisms of the bourgeoisie to be really, really peculiar. In fact, one of the things that you see after the Industrial Revolution is the emergence of the bourgeois family in a way that you really haven't seen before. Indeed, if you take it that marriage was something that was largely confined to the wealthy because they had property to defend, whereas those who weren't wealthy simply sort of lived together in de facto, what we now think as common law marriages. In the late 18th and 19th century, marriage is something that is entered into with gusto by the bourgeoisie, and indeed even those people, even the proletariat. Okay, and it's not until that we reached the 1960s and 1970s after the sexual revolution and the technological revolution, that marriage begins to go out of fashion again. So in a curious way, the ties that bind, the non-commercial ties that bind in the family, if they do anything, in fact, increase and develop rather than decline. It's really peculiar.
We could go on here. I mean, when your bullet points, you've got religious fervor has been subordinated to egotistical calculation. Well, as an atheist, why was this egotistical calculation would have to be preferable to what he would think is just pure superstition and mythology?
Yeah, again, very, very odd. And there are, if you like, you can see, and people have argued that Marxism is, in a sense, an ersatz religion. And to some extent, the part from having, if you like, a future state, an eschatological state, in which the communist well-being of everybody in the future, if you like, takes the place of the Christian heaven. It's also the case that the kind of attachment that people would have to one another and the way in which they would relate would be the kind of ways in which, in an idyllic Christian state, for example, they would relate to one another. But in a sense, Marx is not entitled to have that, right? You can't have your cake and eat it too, right? So, but it is very peculiar. There is this, people tend to think of Marx as being sort of dry as dust, and indeed, if you read Capital, of course, that's the impression you get. But there is, I think, I mean, what kept him? Here's the question. What kept a man sitting on his own in the British Museum for the best part of 30 years, essentially unrecognized, unrewarded by the general population, ignored. Because remember, he was just one of many expatriates living in London, inhabiting the British Museum. He was no more, if you like, well-known than anybody else. And indeed, he wouldn't have survived without the subvention received from Engels. So what keeps a guy in here? And there's some kind of quasi-religious commitment which drives him forward and keeps him going through all of those arid years.
Well, good question. What would keep somebody going through reading all these works is the real question, right? I mean, particularly, well, anyway, we'll get to Capital probably later, but let's turn to the topic of alienation. I think some people here, and Rothbard in his History of Economic Thought says that what Marx meant by alienation is something much more extreme than what most people think. They think maybe it means boredom when you're working on an assembly line or something like that, but it's much more radical and sweeping than that. How would you explain his view of alienation?
All right, well, as I see it, alienation, again, comes from the early thought of Marx, and to some extent is replaced in Marx's later ideas by the notion of exploitation. But the alienation here is the idea that somehow the conditions of modern life, as it were, eviscerate your very soul from you, so that you're, in a sort of radical metaphysical sense, you're separated from what is really you in some deep way. Now, there are four particular kinds of alienation. The worker, he thinks, is alienated from the product of his work. So you make a chair, and the chair is outside you and it's apart from you, and then somebody, as it were, comes and takes the chair away. So the product of your work is removed from you, is alienated from you. Okay, that's one thing. You're alienated in a deeper sense from the very act of working, because what you are forced to do in order to make a living is to engage, at least not everybody, but many people, you're forced to engage in forms of labor that are not really an expression of your personality, and therefore your act of working is alienated. Now, those two forms of alienation make some kind of sense, and we can critique them, but they're not obviously crazy. But then more deeply, Marx thinks that the worker is alienated from himself in a way over and above being alienated from his work and his act of working. And then, of course, alienated from other workers. This comes back to the point about, you know, the breakdown of the ties that bind and the romantic associations. Now, I'm kind of puzzled by some of these. For a start, I don't know what it means to be alienated from the product of your work. Of course you're alienated from the product of your work. That's what it means to produce something. I mean, even Aristotle recognized that between techne and poesis, when you engage in, like, whether it's carpentry or painting or whatever it might be, you produce something which isn't you. And because it isn't you, it can be removed from you without causing your destruction. Of course you're alienated from your work. That's the very nature of work. So I'm not going to break down and weep for this one. For the act of working, well, yeah, I mean, we can all understand this. I mean, there are a few of us, I suppose, who are lucky enough to be involved, who make our living from the kinds of things that we actually enjoy doing. But if you think about it in the context of what most people have done through most of human history, most people have found work to be a chore, okay? And indeed, the classical approach to work was to regard it as something that no gentleman, no well-brought-up person would have to do. Manual labor was not something that was respected. Well, fine. But even as I remark in the book, I mean, presumably even prehistoric man was alienated from his labor if he'd spent a long day sort of slogging through the bush trying to catch some game only to see it bounding over the horizon, okay, and thinking about having to return home to his wife with nothing to show for his day's labor. So in a way, if you were to be as sympathetic as you could be to Marx in this regard, you'd have to think, well, yes, there's something in what he's saying, but that's the human condition. It's not the human condition simply in a capitalist society. It's just the human condition. Okay, most people don't find their work all that rewarding all the time. Even those of us who enjoy our work sometimes find that we have to get up in the morning and get out and lecture when we don't particularly want to. Okay, so I don't know that we can make much more of that. I'm really sort of puzzled by it. Again, it seems to me to be an expression of a sort of deep romanticism which doesn't relate to reality all that well.
And of course, you're serving other people. And sometimes when you serve other people in other areas of your life other than work, even that's not that pleasant. I mean, when you're up all night with a child who's sick, it's not like being up all night in and of itself is a great thing. and that you would choose to do it if the circumstances were different. You're doing it because you want to help somebody else. And the same thing goes with your work. Your work is aimed at helping other people. And it's this whole, this way of thinking I find to be so self-centered that I should be able to just skip through a meadow all day instead of having to do this drudgery. But the drudgery helps other people. You skipping through a meadow helps only you. And yet these are the ones who accuse us of being selfish and self-centered and whatever else. Now, is it then the division of labor itself that Marx is after? And if so, what belongs in its place?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, you remember, of course, Tom, that even Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations makes some critical remarks about the division of labor.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, so somebody's sitting all day, if you like, making buttons, is not going to find it all that fulfilling. But again, I don't understand what's going on here. First of all, it's a very recent idea in our human history that your work should be, if you like, a some kind of transcendent source of fulfillment for you. Okay, this has not been the human experience, right? And moreover, we don't live to work; we work to live. And most normal people, find that even if their work isn't particularly stimulating or fulfilling, that their fulfillment comes from the relations they enjoy with their loved ones and their families and their friends. So, even their hobbies or whatever else they do. So the idea is, if your work is less than sort of totally satisfying, you are somehow less of a human being than you otherwise would be. But again, I'm not very sympathetic to that way of thinking.
Well, nor am I. Now, how does this... Let's talk about exploitation then, because I'm sorry we have to just zip over everything, but at least give people a taste of the major terms and ideas associated with Marx, because the exploitation then is going to tie in to some degree to the labor theory of value, because the labor theory of value will show that exploitation exists. Now, even the word exploitation, there's some lack of clarity about precisely Marx's posture with regard to it. Is he simply dispassionately and scientifically describing a phenomenon that must exist under capitalism, or is he engaged in a moral condemnation of it? There's a good discussion of this in David Conway's book, A Farewell to Marx, which is a book I recommend on Marx. But we shouldn't be recommending any book other than Freedom's Progress right now by well, Jared Casey.
If you want to recommend another book, there's David Gordon's Resurrecting Marx, which is a superb book, by the way, and I don't think it gets all the credit it should. Terrific book, which I made shameless use of, by the way, in my chapter.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah,
I make shameless use of David all the time, and it's served me quite well. So well,
it serves him right for telling better jokes than I do.
right. Now, describe when a typical Westerner uses the word exploitation, the person means it in a more colloquial sense. Marx meant something rather specific and technical by it, which is why the word evokes in us a moral response. But he may not necessarily have intended one, because he is just saying, well, this is the way capitalism works, and this happens, and then this happens. So what is it that's happening that yields us the term exploitation?
Okay, so the colloquial use is, let's just run by it very quickly. I mean, if I steal from you, right, if I take your property without your permission and convert it to my own use, then clearly I've exploited you in that sense, and that's both illegal and indeed immoral. But I think the sort of standard account of exploitation given by Marxists, by the way, and not necessarily by Marx, I'll come back to that in a second, is that exploitation involves a situation in which, in a capitalist economy, the capitalist uses the worker and pays him for a certain amount of work that he does, but forces him somehow to work for more than that, and then keeps the difference between what the worker is paid for in terms of his production and the extra amount, and that extra amount is the exploitation. Now, I say that's a sort of standard account and not necessarily Marx's account, because there is, as you might expect, scholars actually argue about this and so on. But so that would be the idea. And if I engage with you, contract with you for X, and I force you to produce X plus delta, or, you know, some supplement on top of that, then in a sense, I got the delta. I've got the extra amount in a suspicious manner, and if that's the case, then yes, there has been exploitation. I've been taken advantage of in some particular way. Now, is this necessarily part of the way capitalism works? Again, scholars differ on this, but I think that the standard account says, yes, this has to be the way in which capitalists, as it were, make money by, as it were, paying for a certain amount of work, but getting the worker to work more and then keeping the difference. And that's where the capitalist gains, makes his profit from. I don't know about this. Again, if you read Marx on this, well, reading Marx, by the way, by the time you get to the later Marx, I mean, reading Marx, whatever charm there is in the Communist Manifesto, there is very little charm in Capital. And it's very difficult somehow to understand exactly what it is that Marx is doing. So in the chapter on Marx, one of my longer quotes, indeed one of the longest quotes in the book, is from Marx, where I reproduce the passage where he tries to explain how all of this works. And I leave it to the reader to figure out whether he can make any sense of it, any better sense of it than I can. There is another account, however, of exploitation. The Marx scholar Leszek Kolakowski points out that...
Which I've read some of his stuff. I had not read what he had to say about exploitation.
Yeah.
This blew my mind.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And it goes to show, again, this is why we made the remark earlier about the difference between Marxism and Marx. And Kolakowski says, and I'm quoting now, he says, Marx himself ridiculed the utopians and LaSalle for holding that the worker should receive, in the form of wages, the whole equivalent of the values produced by him, but rather that surplus value should accrue to society in various ways that, in fact, it actually does under capitalism. Now, this is not the standard sort of account, but, you know, Kolakowski tends to know what he's talking about. And in that case, exploitation then concerns not, if you like, a form of robbery of the individual worker, but rather a kind of lack of control by society over the use of surplus product. And it's more or less, and not something that can be totally eliminated. And then Kolakowski goes on to say, and this is really, really bizarre, he goes on to say that if instead of private ownership, the power to control the means of production and distribution were to be confined to a small ruling group, uncontrolled by any measure of representative democracy, think the Soviet Union, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
There would be not less exploitation, but a great deal more, okay? Which, again, should give any Marxist pause to think.
Yeah.
So that socialist communities, in fact, wouldn't, with the examples not of the abolition of exploitation, but indeed of exploitation in an extreme degree.
Yeah, exactly. So fun to turn these things around on Marx. Now, there, I personally find it rather technical to tie in, I mean, it can be done, but I don't know how easily it can be done on a podcast, to tie in precisely how the labor theory of value is necessary for the exploitation theory. Now, later on, by the way, of course, a lot of Marxists will say, we don't need the labor theory of value. Maybe Marx, you know, who knows if he was right or wrong about it, but that's not necessary to Marxism. But yet, as you see it expounded, the labor theory of value is distinctly tied up with exploitation theory. So if there's no labor theory of value, where does the exploitation come from? And then if there's no exploitation, where's the class-based revolution going to come from? It seems like it does kind of stand or fall on the labor theory of value.
Well, yes, I think indeed it does. And one of the virtues of David Gordon's book, Resurrecting Marx, is he considers those writers, I suppose you'd call them sort of revisionist Marxists, some of whom attempt to get, because of the embarrassment of the labor theory of value, try to get rid of it, and therefore have to find a substitute which will explain the whole notion of exploitation. And he argues, I think, very convincingly in that book that they haven't really managed to do it. Sort of Marx without the labor theory of value is a bit like Hamlet without the Prince of Denmark.
Yeah, indeed. So, say something, though, about the labor theory of value. It's easy to caricature this. He's not saying that if you spend 10 hours, you know, making pies out of beach sand, that means they have to have value because you worked on them. It doesn't mean anything like that.
Well, the sort of naive version of the labor theory of value would say that something is worth some the value of an object that is made or manufactured is equal to the amount of labor that went into it. Now, the trouble is that labor, of course, is physical activity or mental activity, and it's hard to know how you would actually quantify that in some particular way. But of course, it doesn't take much to see that even if you got over those difficulties, it would be tricky to explain that. So the example I give in the book is if I if I have some bizarre hobby of constructing the Taj Mahal out of bits of wood, and it takes me 20 years to do it, and I work in it sort of 40 hours a week, and I say, oh, my labor's worth at least $5 an hour, and therefore my now wooden construction of the Taj Mahal is worth, I don't know, $250,000. The thing is, well, is it? I mean, who's going to give you that for it? Right? And the answer is no one. So the naive view, the naive account of the labor theory value, of course, will immediately falls to the ground. And so Marx then comes up with the notion of socially useful labor. But the trouble is, the advantage of the labor theory of value, the naive one, is that you can actually count the number of hours that somebody works. The trouble when to get rid of the idiocies of that particular theory, you start refining your notion of labor to make it socially useful labor, you've now lost the sort of immediate intuitive grasp that was obvious in that particular account. And so who decides what socially useful labor is? And again, so what you've done is you've swapped out one difficulty and you've given yourself another. So whichever way you look at it, you're going to end up in trouble. Who determines what socially useful labor is? And again, today, after marginal utility, we would say, well, basically the consumer or the purchaser of the goods or services, the one who decides, what it's worth. And the market, which is the network, the nexus, if you like, of all those relationships, all of those commercial relationships that we involve in, will in fact settle on a value for the time being, and it will shift depending on particular people's needs and interests and desires. So whichever way you go, the labor theory of value really is a very sort of weak read to build your theory of exploitation on.
Can we move now to his theory of history?
Yes.
All right, so the history is driven by class struggle, so then we have to talk about class. And Rothbard's view was that class is actually very badly defined in Marx. This central concept is badly defined. So what's your best effort to define that and then explain how it's the driver of history?
Well, again, I mean, you're asking me to do something that Marx himself couldn't do, because he was working on this notion up to the day he died. He was still writing about it and still hadn't quite figured out. But I think the intuitive idea, there's something in it. And of course, he wasn't the one who invented this idea. He took it over. This is not a criticism, by the way. He took it over from earlier thinkers. And the idea is that, if you call it, let's talk about A and B. There's the exploiters and the exploited. That in every stage of history, you have these two groups present in some form or another. And what history involves is that when the conflict between the exploiters and the exploited is resolved, okay, it gives rise to another form of social structure. And again, the distinction between exploiters and exploited emerges until we reach a stage of communist organization, when eventually the distinction will finally collapse and there won't be any tension. I think there's actually something in the idea of a class struggle, but I think that what Marx did is he misidentified it. Okay, and I know I'm stealing from Hans Hermann Hoppe. The idea is that yes, we find that in the society in which we live, there's a tension, if you like, between those people who work for a living, manufacturing things or laboring and exchanging merchants and so on, and those who actually live off them. In various ways, not least the government and the associated government classes. So I think that distinction, if you like, between the exploiter and the exploited, comes all the way through from the very beginning, from the very earliest states, and we still have it with us. There are tax producers and there are tax consumers. Okay, and I'd love to be a sort of neo-communist and think that the day will arrive when that tension will disappear. But I'm not holding my breath.
All right, so let's get to the theory of history, in which history is not just one thing after another, but history is heading toward a goal, and Marx thinks he can point to particular periods of history and show how we move from one to the other by means of mechanics that he can describe for us. So how does it work?
Well, again, he takes this idea really from Hegel, with the idea that there is this kind of thesis and antithesis. And there's kind of an energy or a tension between them, and eventually that's sort of resolved. But until it all comes to an end in some idyllic future state, you're going to have that antithesis and thesis division repeated. So he argues, for example, that in every age, the dominant mode of economic production and exchange, together with the form of social organization, which it has, form a base on which is constructed the political and intellectual life. So that we tend to think that our ideas, if you like, are influential in controlling our environment and the conditions in which we live, our religion and our politics. But Marx actually argues the other way around, that it's the forms of economic production which determines the way in which we think. The whole of human history, he thinks, is made up of a very forms of class struggles. Capitalism is the latest one. Before that, we had the feudal one. But he thinks that in the case of the capitalist struggle, we're going to have between the exploited class, which is the proletariat, once we reach a communist situation, or rather when this tension between exploiter and exploited is finally resolved, then there will be no more class struggle.
Now, there are some problems with this, of course. And first of all, the idea that our ideas basically are derived from our economic conditions by the prevailing means of production, that everything is determined by material things. But then Mises asked the question, and I hope I don't butcher this, but Mises basically said, well, where do these means of production come from? They didn't fall from the sky. They came from a process that involves the division of labor. The division of labor comes about through the intellectual process of figuring out that the division of labor yields greater productivity than isolation. So obviously it took a non-material process, namely the thinking about and theorizing about the division of labor, to give us the means of production in the first place. So ideas trump matter, obviously, just in the way we got the means of production. Is that what he said? I hope I'm not screwing that up.
No, that sounds correct to me. It's okay. Look, there's a certain, again, in there's nothing worse than a half-truth, because if something is sort of, you know, screamingly false, anybody can see it. Half-truths are harder to deal with. It's certainly true that, in a way, that the conditions in which we live make certain kinds of ways of thinking possible and maybe make other ways of thinking more difficult. I don't think that's too problematic. What's problematic about Marx's account is that the modes of production determine your thought. And most of us would think, well, hang on a second, it's surely reciprocal. Surely it's the case that the ways in which we think, if you like, as you just said, enable us to develop various forms of production. Those forms of production make possible other ways of thinking. Those ways of thinking make further ways of production possible, and so on and so forth. So it's interactional, right? Marx wants it unidirectional, and that's bizarre.
Well, then we get to the question of how is it that somebody, let's say somebody who's a member of the proletariat, the proletariat is supposed to think a certain way about certain things because of their relations to the means of production, because that determines their thought. How do we account for somebody, for example, like me? I grew up or my father, who was a blue collar worker, and he had no sympathy for communism whatsoever. How would Marx be able to account for that?
Well, I don't think he can. My father was also a blue collar worker, and it's very strange, because what the notion of false consciousness involves is that somehow our ways of thinking are supposed to be determined by the modes of production that prevail in the society in which we live. Therefore, you would think everybody who lives in that social structure should have their ways of thinking determined by it. Does that not follow from the thesis? And the answer is yes. But somehow, miraculously, I don't quite know how, and it's a bit like the guy sort of waves a magic wand. Somebody waves a magic wand, and some individual or some small group of individuals is able, as it were, to think outside the box. Now, that's cheating, because on Marx's account, that's not really possible. But nonetheless, some people are able to, as it were, escape the conditions, the material conditions of their society. We find the same thing, for example, in fact, Rousseau is the father of this idea. But of course, you find it today in various forms of feminism. The idea, for example, that, you know, if a woman, for example, wanted to choose, say, to work inside the home and found that fulfilling, she would be told that she's suffering from false consciousness. And of course, the answer, there's a logical problem with this. And it's if all our thinking is determined by the material conditions of production, okay, and so why then isn't false consciousness universal, right? And in fact, In other words, if consciousness is false, it can be false only if it's possible for consciousness not to be false. Because if it's all false, then it makes no sense. It's incoherent, right? Something is, for example, something is false only if it's possible for another proposition to be true. And therefore, if there isn't a true consciousness, right, you can't have a false consciousness. But of course, on the Marxist account, it's very difficult to explain how you can actually have a true consciousness. That's leaving aside the question of why it is that some particular enlightened group of individuals manages to be the recipient of this, and why it's not open, for example, to those who are accused of having false consciousness, why it isn't open to them to turn around and say to those who claim to have some form of true consciousness, it's the other way around, buddy. Okay. Why is it that it isn't you who's actually suffering from false consciousness, and that I and my fellow thinkers indeed have the true consciousness? So the whole idea is incoherent. It maybe would help if I gave another example. In Freudianism, for example, when you went to see your analyst and he came up with an account of why it is that you were having the problems that you were having, and you said, but it, you know, because you had, I don't know, suffered abuse as a child or whatever it might have been, and you said, but this never happened. And he would say, well, of course it did. And the fact that you're denying it is simply an affirmation of the fact that you're resisting the account. This is simply more evidence in favor of my theory. And of course, if you have a theory that is simply unfalsifiable, nothing in principle could ever actually turn it around, then it's completely vacuous. And the notion of false consciousness is completely vacuous. And Marx's account of the determination of thought from the conditions of production is in the end vacuous.
The last couple of things I wanted to ask you, first I was going to be, what is it that Marx wants? And then I realized he would never phrase it that way. It doesn't matter what I want, it's going to happen. It's the unfolding of the historical process. Whether I want it or not is completely immaterial. So, all right, so I won't phrase it that way. Let's say it instead, what does Marx expect? What is the society toward which he believes history is aiming going to look like? Now, okay, even that you can't ask him, because he'll say, only the utopian socialist could give you the precise outline of exactly what the socialist society would be like. Okay, but certainly he knows there will not be private ownership of the means of production. So what else can we figure out about where history is going?
Okay, so clearly the means of production will be held, if you like, by society at large or by its vanguard. You will have, so there won't be any property in land. You will have a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. The rights of inheritance will either be circumscribed severely or abolished. The credit will be centralized in the hands of the state, as will communication and transport. Everybody will be required to work to the same extent, and so on. These things are what Marx thinks will happen when the communists seize power. Now, the really depressing thing about that is that even in those countries where the communists haven't seized power, much of this program has, in fact, been implemented. So property in land mightn't actually have been formally abolished, but we have heavy taxation and death duties, estate duties, which means that landowners, in effect, rent their land from the state. I mean, you have property taxes, so you actually are renting your house from the state. Inheritance hasn't been formally abolished, but taxes and death duties diminish the ability of people to leave the wealth that they've accumulated through their lives to their heirs. Progressive income tax is a standard feature of almost every Western democracy. Central banks are in effect state-owned, even if they're legally independent. And until recently, communications and transport were state-organized and state-run, and have only recently been returned to private or semi-private ownership. I don't know if Marx would be happy about this, but if he were to come back today and he would see that maybe, I don't know, 75% of the communist program has actually been instantiated in the so-called middle way economies of the West.
Well, that leads me, I guess, to probably the last question, which is, what does Marx view as the role of the state in all this? We all know about the state supposedly withering away at the end of the historical process, but what role, for example, does the state play under capitalism, in his view? And before you get to pure communism, the state is still there. What role is it playing then?
Okay, so in the capitalist economy, the state is effectively a sort of a subcommittee of the oppressors. Okay, it exists, if you like, to further their ends and to make the laws that make it possible for the oppressors to continue oppressing and exploiting. So that's its function primarily in a capitalist society. When you reach a communist society, the state is supposed to exist only, as it were, temporarily or in passing, and its role largely is to make itself superfluous. It's supposed to fade away eventually, because the relations that will then exist in the communist utopia between individuals will be such that the functions that are exercised by the state will no longer be necessary. And the answer to that is, oh, yeah.
Yeah, really?
Oh, yeah. No. So that's what's supposed to happen. The withering away of the state, I think, is the expression that's used. But again, you're going to hold your breath while you wait for the state to wither away. And we've had plenty of historical examples in the bloody 20th century to show that, far from it being the case that the state withers away, all that happens is that the reins of power, once grasped by a group, are firmly held by it and only relinquished, okay, when they're unable to hold on any longer.
Without being melodramatic, let's talk about if there's continuing relevance of the ideas of Marx today. I mean, I know it's easy to call people communists when they're really not. There's almost nobody asking for the state or social ownership of the means of production anymore. A lot of the really central things that made socialism are not really what people are asking for anymore. Or they're not disparaging the idea of markets. They're not saying markets are less efficient than socialism. All those sorts of arguments have gone by the wayside. So is there still any continuing relevance of these ideas, or are we just looking at them as historical curiosities?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that one. I live very close, of course, to the United Kingdom here, and the rise and rise of Jeremy Corbyn seems like that socialist recidivism is on the rise. We begin to see the sort of generally accepted middle ground that the Labour Party in England had, which is that we have to accept the market and kind of work with it. It seems to be under a bit of pressure from Corbyn. He may, in fact, have to face up to reality and realize that he can't, in fact, do without it like every other Labour leader. But nonetheless, the rhetoric is startlingly old-fashioned. So, yes, I mean, I think by and large, you're right. But nonetheless, communism, even as a sort of even if it's in its extremities, is not something that anybody particularly wants or thinks can be instantiated. It still operates as a kind of an ideal, which allows socialism in all its forms in Europe and maybe even to some extent in the United States to function in a way and provides a justification for it. Not least by virtue of the fact that you can say to people, well, you know, whatever you think about socialism, at least it's not as bad as communism. So, kind of live with it.
Well, unfortunately, it just seems to be the case that a lot of bad ideas don't fully go away. I mean, I think there are still some assumptions about the way the world works that a lot of people hold on to, even though they're not Marxists. They still look at they view capitalism as being subject to internal contradictions that lead to crises, that it's subject to bouts of overproduction, that it has these internal cycles. That's out of Marx. I mean, that's out of a lot of people, but Marx believed that. And if we take the moralistic version of his discussion of exploitation, I think some people kind of believe in something like that. So even though they probably don't even know they come from Marx, I mean, for crying out loud, look at how many times you take polls of American students and they think from each according to his ability to each according to his need is taken out of the U.S. Constitution. So you know, these things still need to be talked about and smashed, because even if you don't have outright Marxists on your hands, you have people who just casually buy into a lot of really crummy and patently false assumptions. So you're here to help us smash them.
I agree. I mean, there's a saying that you shouldn't, there's no point in flogging a dead horse. But even though some horses appear to be dead, they really need to be soundly flogged again and again and again.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Their sort of zombie-like capacity to resurrect is amazing. I mean, Terry Eagleton wrote a book a few years ago called Why Marx Was Right. And I had the opportunity to take part in a debate with him at Trinity College in the Historical Society. Which he helped me to win, by the way, not deliberately. He was on the other side. The motion was that this house welcomes the demise of global capitalism. And he was so annoying that he actually managed to get the crowd of with its students to come down on my side, which is totally amazing. But in his book, you know, having gone through why he thinks Marx is right and all of these things, he has this wonderfully kind of economically naive idea that we can have an economy that is neither centrally planned nor market governed, and in which the resources are supposed to be allocated by negotiation. He never says between whom, by the way. And policy is to be determined by representative assemblies through a process of devolved and detailed planning. Oh my God, that sounds like hell on earth.
Yeah. Okay. That would never end. There'd be dead bodies on the floor by the time that meeting was over.
Well, if you ever wanted frosties, you're going to be waiting for them, because you have to wait for the committee and the subcommittees and everything to get together and sort it out. You don't know whether to laugh or to weep. You know, I mean, like, could we not agree at this stage, after, you know, 100 years of communism in various forms, that central planning of a complex economy hasn't worked, doesn't work, and cannot work? Surely we could agree on that. And the answer is no, I'm afraid we can't. Just like your students who think that, you know, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, is sort of like, I don't know, holy writ. These things come up again and again and again and need to be hit firmly on the head every time they arise.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Well, that's what we're doing. You're here. You're our righteous smasher with your glorious hammer. The hammer, by the way, is your book, Freedom's Progress, A History of Political Thought. And the thing is so huge and heavy, it actually might be more lethal than a hammer. So it's definitely, definitely worth reading. And yes, it's going to be pricier than the average book, but this book is 1,000 pages. It's like 4 books. So if you're getting it for the price of 2 or 3, that's still a bargain. So I want to urge people to check it out at tomwoods.com/1012, which is our show notes page for today. Get your copy of this book. It's just this good on every topic that it covers. So definitely do that. And Professor Casey, we're going to get you back on again. We're going to talk about something else.
All right. Whenever you want, Tom, whenever you want.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye now.
All right, folks. I got a podcast to tell you about, brand new or new-ish, from a voluntarist or libertarian perspective. It's called Our Coward Kings, which you can check out at ourcowardkings.com. And as you scroll down, you'll see there are episodes on Here's Your Quick Guide to the Economic Problems with Socialism, or Here's How Government Racks Up So-Called Temporary Government Programs During Crises and How They Become Ossified into Permanent Government Programs, or Don't Be Afraid of Automation, which of course takes on an important topic these days, episodes on the non-aggression principle, on taxation, on money, is it really the root of all evil? An excellent array of topics, very much worth checking out at ourcowardkings.com. Of course, you get publicity like this too if you use my link when you get your hosting. And when you use my link, you also get the best price Bluehost has for hosting. And you can get the details on this and all the other bonuses you get that give you a nice burst of free traffic right out of the gate with your brand new site. Get the details on how to do all that and get all these nice bonuses at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, next week, if all goes well, I got James Damore from Google, and we'll check in with him and see what he's up to now and lessons learned and perspective he's gained over the time since the controversy hit. So we got that going on. I've got several things that I think I'm going to be able to swing, but we're just going to have to wait and see. But if I can get Ron Paul back on to talk about his new book next week, I am just going to move mountains to make that happen. I have a bonus episode coming up this weekend, and then next weekend I have another bonus episode. By popular demand, I've had people say, why don't you talk more to listeners of the show? And I thought, okay. I have had a bunch of listeners on. I can think of at least half a dozen, probably more, who just have interesting stories that I've wanted to share, like the guy who was a police officer and then he read Rothbard and decided he didn't want to do that anymore. I mean, interesting stuff like that. But in particular, how about success stories? Because I'm always talking about, why don't you start a website to do X or Y, whatever. What about people who've had success with that? So I've got some excellent examples, people from my private Facebook group or my bloggers group who have had a lot of success, basically just following steps that I've recommended. Let's talk about it. What did they do? How did they do it? I think that'll make for a good one. So that's going to be weekend after this coming one. So that'll be, I don't know, I can't calculate the number. How am I going to know what episode number that is? That'd be impossible. I'd need an advanced degree to figure that out. But that's coming up by early October. I'll just put it that way. And speaking of early October, I very much hope to see some of you at the Mises Institute's 35th anniversary event in New York City, which is going to be out of this world, like once-in-a-lifetime event. I just cannot wait for that. So hope to see you there. If not, hope you'll be listening in to the next episode of The Tom Woods Show. See you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.